From the right, I'm Matt Lewis.
From the left, I'm Bill Scher.
And you're watching
The Week in Blog.
On today's episode, we discuss healthcare, Glenn Beck, and climate change. But first, President Obama addressed the UN General Assembly this week, and predictably, conservatives were not impressed. National Review's Rich Lowry wrote that Obama's speech had one striking resemblance to a Bush speech. It's unwarranted, overly optimistic generalizations about what people want. With Bush, everyone in the world was just a little bit beneath the surface, a freedom-loving Democrat. With Obama, Lowry writes, everyone is a peace-loving multilateralist. But most conservatives felt the biggest problem was his apologies for America. As commentaries, Peter Weiner wrote, quote, President Obama once again succumbed to what has become an almost clinical addiction, criticizing the United States in front of an international audience. So, Bill, what do you have to say? Is this an example of conservative bloggers just reflexively attacking Obama, or is there anything to their criticism?
Well, it's not quite reflexively attacking, but it's trying to create this narrative about his persona that strikes me as... I find a lot of things that conservatives say about Obama to be off the mark, of course, but I find some particularly detached from reality, because anybody who actually looks at these speeches does not hear what conservatives are saying, because these aren't apologies.
Let me
the word apology.
Let me give you a quick example, and then I'll jump back out. But he said America has too often been selective in promotion of democracy. And that's one of the lines that conservative bloggers have been repeating.
Well, two things about stuff like that. I mean, number one, this is the most important. You know, if you look at what Obama's done, all these foreign policy speeches, the theme of it is owning up to things that America has done that we're not well received in the rest of the world, that Obama does not believe in himself and was elected on a promise of changing those things. So it's not like it's some sort of bait and switch. This is all part and parcel of what the campaign was about.
Right. I think that's true. He's been doing this the whole time.
I'm sorry?
I agree. He's been doing this the whole time. But, Bill,
right.
The problem I have is when you're at an event where Ahmadinejad is and Muammar Gaddafi is, and there's a chance for, I think, real moral clarity to be critical of your own country. That rubs some people the wrong way.
But it's all about moral clarity, because the whole point of it is he always couples that with a parallel chiding of the actions of other countries when they're not stepping up to the plate and being responsible too.
Right.
The whole point of it is to have the street cred, to have the moral authority, to lean on those other countries, to have them change their behavior.
Right.
It's not going down on bended knee.
Well,
it's
Bill,
a stern lecture from your dad.
Let me actually do something I rarely do, which is agree with you. And I'll tell you why I agree with you. Because this has less to do with Obama's being a blame America firster, and it has more to do with his style of argumentation. This is what he does personally when he'll start off saying, now I know some people are going to say that I'm some liberal, and some people are going to say that, you know, he'll sort of set up all these bad things about himself. It's almost a blame Obama first mentality, you might say. But he does that, and it's a style of argumentation, which frankly I think is growing quite thin and predictable, but that's his MO. That's what he does. He sets it up by sort of saying, now, some people might say this about me, some people might say that about me, and they might say, I got to be honest, liberals or Democrats, we've made these mistakes. So he's sort of coming across as reasonable by admitting he's made mistakes, or that his side has made mistakes. Then he goes on the attack, he goes in for the kill. And so I think what he's doing is actually... It's very consistent with his brand of argumentation, which has gotten him this far.
Now, if conservatives want to try to make an argument that style of argument is not enough to change the behavior of other countries, and you'd have an argument that not a whole lot has changed to date, I might argue it's only been a few months, cut the guy a little slack, judge him at the end of 4 years, But, you know, that would be a more legitimate criticism to make. But to pretend that he's giving a speech that he, you know, manifestly did not give.
But I think, though, I will say this, though.
I think that's making it harder for conservatives to get back into the game and be taken seriously.
Well, in defense of these conservatives, I will say it is one thing to sort of criticize yourself in the process of setting up an argument. It's another thing to criticize your political philosophy or your political party's history in order to set up an argument. It's entirely different to go to the United Nations before an international audience and to criticize your own country in order to set up an argument. So,
well, I mean, this is a bit of a nuanced point, but I don't think it's fair to say he's criticizing his country. He's not blaming America for the ails of the world. He's basically going there and saying, hey, look, guys, there's a lot of blame to go around here. None of us come here with flawless records. So let's all be big boys and girls and own up to our mistakes and start working on how to solve these problems. I think it's a totally different thing than self-flagellation and saying, hey, everything that Gaddafi has said about America is right, that we should all listen to him now. I mean, it's not what he's doing.
And I think conservatives would argue, and again, we could go round and round and round on this, but I think I'll end my part at least by saying I think conservatives would say that when you compare the United States history, which is not by no means perfect, but we did save the world from communism, from fascism, whatever. We have done a lot. I mean, not Matt Lewis or Bill Scheer personally, but our forefathers have built a pretty great country that had some problems, yes, but it was a great country.
Obama says all that.
But when you compare it,
in these speeches.
Right, but when you compare it to Ahmadinejad and Gaddafi, why do you have to go there and talk about the bad stuff? Why not go there and talk about the great things?
He talks about both, which is what adults do. And that's what Obama's strength has always been, that he's the adult in the room, not playing silly political games.
Well, I think he does talk about both. I think it's in order. But I think it's consistent with a form of sophistry and rhetoric, and it's gotten him this far. So.
Well, while the right was criticizing Obama on foreign policy at the UN, there were environmental bloggers who felt let down by his remarks to the UN on climate. Bill McKibben at Mother Jones called it, quote, a dud, a towering disappointment. Obama used it mostly to downplay expectations, and it's those downplay expectations that may prove to be tragically self-fulfilling. Emily Gertz at Change.org said it was, quote, long in generalities and short on substance. But the criticism not uniform. Climate progress, as Joe Rahm was enthusiastic. Obama's blunt remarks should give heart to all climate science realists at home and abroad that he will, in fact, bring all of his political and rhetorical skills to bear on passing climate and clean energy legislation in the next several months. So, Matt, do you think Obama is raising expectations by his climate remarks at the UN, or is he lowering expectations by those remarks?
I don't think either, but I will say this. I mean, look, I think the people who eat, breathe, and sleep this issue wanted him to go there and to lay out specific, you know, policy prescriptions. They wanted him to pressure Congress, and they are absolutely insane because Barack Obama is already engaged. You want to talk about the United States military being overstretched. The Barack Obama policy sort of goal is overstretched. He's already trying to sell America on this nationalizing 1/6 of the U.S. economy. Most Americans don't want to do it. He's trying to sell them something that I think he thought the world had changed and the paradigm had shifted, but guess what? It hasn't. He's already overextended. He's out on a limb trying to push through, you know, healthcare policy and cap and trade and things that really aren't at the core traditional American, I would say, policies. And the idea that he would take on yet another controversial topic and be more specific than he was, and he spoke in generalities, I think is insanity. So I don't read anything into it. I don't think this means he's going to do more or he's not going to do more. I think that politically speaking, he could not realistically, you know, call on Congress or pressure Congress to do anything.
Well, we'll talk about healthcare more, I think, at the end of the segment, so I won't get too far into that critique. But I think there's a you know, a Washington conventional wisdom sense that there's no way Obama could do climate after this. This is sapping his political capital, no matter what happens. And Congress feels, you can't make me take two tough votes in 1 year, you know, kind of thing. What we don't know is, well, there's a bunch of things we don't know. We don't know how politically the landscape will change after a bill gets passed.
Right.
Does it end up being a depletion of political capital or an investment that pays off in dividends that gives you the energy to do the next thing? And Obama has said in previous remarks, you know, Washington's sort of out of shape. It hasn't had to, you know, flex its legislative muscles in a while, and we're whipping it into shape. So we'll see how hard he wants to push them after the healthcare process is finished. I think there's definitely a concern in the environmental blogosphere that Obama is not putting his shoulder to the grindstone in the same way that he is on healthcare. They're concerned that that the energy is not going to be there once mm-hmm. this is done. And so there was a bit of an expectation. Oh, he's going to speak at the UN. He's really going to give his first big climate speech. Everyone wants their Obama speech.
Right.
The Obama speech about their topic.
And that's going to be the problem that he has when everybody who worked, you know, this coalition who worked hard to get him elected, and they right. all have their pet project or their pet issue. And,
there's all this pent-up liberal demand for so
right.
long, and Obama's been trying to prioritize and tamp things. I mean, to the criticism he gets that he's doing too much, in many ways he's having to kind of keep a lot of people on the left at bay.
Right. No, I'm sure. But I will say this. I mean, look.
This was the first climate speech, and whatever you say about it, I don't think it wasn't the climate speech. It wasn't
right.
the climate speech for the ages that will be written in the history books. Because he is hemmed in by what happens in the Senate. He can't say the U.S. will do X because he is not the dictator of the Senate. And we don't know what they're going to do yet.
Well, and look, here's the other thing, too, Bill. You're correct that we don't know what the political environment is going to be. It may be that things turn around for Democrats. But right now, it doesn't look good for Democrats going to the 2010 elections. I think there's a very real possibility that Republicans will take back the House, if not double digits pickups at least. And I just don't know. In a way, conservatives maybe should hope he takes on too much. I mean, it's so funny. In politics, sometimes you win when you lose and you lose when you win. And then you end up caring about winning, not about actually getting things done. But I have to tell you... that there is a real danger that he is the more that he takes on, I think the greater chance there is for huge upsets in the midterm elections. So, it's going to be an interesting year.
I don't go too deep into the healthcare debate till later, but I do think there's a sense on the Democratic side that when healthcare in 1994, hit a roadblock, and a lot of individual congresspeople said, you know what, I don't have to walk the plank with Bill Clinton. I'm going to worry about my own seat
right.
and not stick my neck out here. Guess what? The whole House fell down. And it was particularly those moderate Democrats in conservative-leaning areas that got burned and let Newt Gingrich take back the House. So I think there's a larger sense that whatever misgivings that some of these congresspeople have, it's going to be better for them to do something than nothing. And we don't know right now what that means politically because we haven't been in that kind of dynamic where there's been a big reform package
yeah.
that got passed coming from the left.
But the problem,
since Medicare.
The problem with that, though, is,
and
Bill,
so we don't know how the fallout will be.
You're right. I agree. We don't know. But my prediction is it's not going to be good. But here's the other thing, though. That's ancient. 1994 is ancient history to a lot of the Democrats. Remember, Republicans controlled the House until 2006. So a lot of the Democrats now serving, they weren't in office. Most of them probably weren't, weren't in office in 94. House members, and so you're going to have to go sort of teach them history to persuade them of this. But if I'm a young conservative or blue dog Democrat elected, and I see these town hall meetings, I don't know that I'm going to be persuaded that the way to be reelected is to double down as opposed to coming to the center. But who knows? I'm sure there are efforts to advance, you know, the 94 analogy. So, commentaries, Peter Weiner, and I say that because I assume it's not Peter Weiner.
You never know.
This week wrote about Glenn Beck, saying, "At a time when we should aim for intellectual depth, for tough-minded and reasonable arguments, for good cheer and calm purpose, rather than erratic behavior, he is not the kind of figure conservatives should embrace or cheer on. But Bill, I'm not going to ask you if Beck is good for conservatism. What I'd like to do is to have you answer a question I received from a viewer named Travis Walker, a Twib fan who tweeted this question. Is it now safe to say that Glenn Beck has become the most influential voice in the Republican Party, more than L. Rushbo? What say you, L. Shero?"
And we should clarify, just in case it wasn't clear, I think Peter Weiner is coming from a conservative vantage point.
Yes.
In criticizing Glenn Beck, saying he is not good for conservatism. Is Beck the most influential voice? I mean, he's not the most influential voice in terms of its, you know, policy agenda, to whatever extent, you know, there is one right now. But he's become the lead, you know, opposition researcher. He's the lead attack dog.
Right.
He is replacing Matt Drudge as I think Atreus has said, the traditional media's assignment editor. When Glenn Beck decides to go after Acorn or go after someone in the NEA, you know, he leads the way and the media will then follow suit. But I think that is different than being the face of the party, which I'm not even sure there really is one still. But he is certainly getting the most attention of any conservative out there. And I think the commentary from Peter Weiner, I mean, Matt, you might know better than me, but I sense there's a little bit of unease here, saying, you know, whatever, however fun it is to watch Glenn Beck, you know, get a few, you know, right hooks in and push out, you know, these sort of small-time stories that have them blow up big and knock Democrats off their game for a time. I think there's a little bit of a sense that, is Glenn Beck really enough of a sound and stable person to really be the guy getting the most face time here?
First of all, thank you, Travis Walker, who tweeted the question at the Weekend blog. For your question, you will receive a week's free back rubs from Bill Scherer. No, we got to come up with a giveaway.
One dead frog from Glenn Beck?
Yes, you will receive something in the mail. But I guess going back to the Weiner question.
Saying, are they just saying Glenn Beck is the greatest guy? He's getting stuff done. Let's follow his lead. Let's help him out. Let's push all these stories. I mean, is there any sense of unease there at saying, is this really, do I really know where this train is headed?
It's an interesting sort of the way this thing is developed, because it sort of, I think, breaks down where you have the younger conservative bloggers like Red State, hot, you know, and more activist sort of blogs like, say, Red State or Michelle Malkin, who love Beck. And then you have like Weiner, who I think he was skeptical of Palin. He's a conservative, but maybe more intellectual. Some of them have sort of sounded the alarm on Beck. I have, as you know, Bill. We've talked about this here.
But you were coming around last week.
Yeah, but the thing is, I think first of all, you cannot deny that he has been incredibly effective, amazingly effective. I'm on Twitter a lot, and I follow a lot of conservatives, and Beck is one of the most popular sort of things to talk about, and there are a lot of Beck fans out there on Twitter. It's a big movement. It's pretty amazing, and I think he was very important in bringing down Van Jones and Acorn, as well as other players, of course. By the same token, I share your concern as, I sit on CBN one time, and I'll sort of echo it. I think he is closer to P.T. Barnum than he is to William F. Buckley. And I think we somewhere, you know, in that sort
of... He'd probably say that himself.
He probably would. And, you know, sort of we're all somewhere, you know, we're all somewhere between the two of them. If you're in entertainment, if you're on TV, if you're a blogger, a writer, a pundit, whatever, you know, you've got to be a little bit of a promoter, right, to make it. So we're all somewhere in between, but I think he's closer to P.T. Barnum than he is. But he's been incredibly effective, and I don't want him to try to take me down like he did Van Jones. So I'm going to be nice to him as much as possible. But it's an it's a very interesting thing.
Let me just point up one example here. You know, we focus a lot when the punches land.
Right.
And then, you know, everyone starts to scatter. You know, Beck also made a big deal about stuff going on at the National Endowment for the Arts, that there was this conference call that happened in August where it seemed like one of the people there was being a little bit too political in coordinating with other artists.
Mm-hmm.
And once this conference call came to light, the NAA said, you know, this was inappropriate and we're reassigning that person. They tried to, this isn't Beck so much, but this is Andrew Breitbart, who runs Big Hollywood and runs the news site Big Government. And Big Government is actually the one that launched these Acorn tapes. And these are two, you know, well-financed, well-promoted blogs. This isn't some sort of scrappy upstart. You know, Breitbart was Drudge's right-hand man. He actually helped out the launch of Huffington Post. And a bit of a cross promotion, if you will. And so they tried to go after someone else in the White House to try to get one more scalp out of this NEA conference call. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of hullabaloo about it. Breitbart did like the super tease, like, get here at 12 noon when we drop the huge bombshell. We got the audio of the conference call. And guess what? It just actually wasn't that much of a story. And it kind of fizzled out. And that,
even Michael Jordan missed a shot every now and then.
No one pays attention to that. So you have to wonder, with all of the hype around this, do they really have an effective long-term strategy to resurrecting conservatism, resurrecting the Republican Party, and making it a credible player in the political scene?
Well, I think let me just speak about Beck specifically. I don't know if what he does is meant to make conservatism a credible, whatever you just said. But I do think he has the potential to take down more people. I think that a lot of the czars have some very sketchy things about them, not just Van Jones, and I would not be surprised if Beck landed another couple punches. This is a recurring theme. We're going to keep talking about this. I will say, interestingly, Joe Scarborough, whom I also follow on Twitter, is not a big fan of Beck. And he tweeted out the Weiner, you know, column post. So for what that's worth, he is a conservative who is also not on the Beck bandwagon.
Should we move on to healthcare?
Let's do it. Let's close out with healthcare today.
So all sorts of healthcare chatter in the blogs for this week, as the Senate Finance Committee has been marking up its legislation, the last committee to get its work done on healthcare reform. Nearly every vote in the Finance Committee has been breaking down along party lines, for the most part, despite Max Baucus' attempt at bipartisanship. Atrios writes, quote, "I guess we'll always wonder whether Obama and his people really thought Republicans might be good faith participants." Steve Bennett at the Washington Monthly and David Dayan, D-Day, mocking Chuck Grassley, the ranking Republican member who was part of Max Baucus' Gang of Six, wouldn't come on board with that legislation, and is now trying to start another bipartisan group with different senators after the Baucus one was a bust. And Chris Bowers at Open Left talking about all the whipping that's been going on in the House, both with the Blue Dogs and with progressives, both trying to stand their ground on issues like the public option and some others. Bowers lamenting that the Blue Dogs get treated differently when they try to say what is non-negotiable than House progressives. And that, I think, speaks to a general sentiment, and generalizing the blogosphere is always fraught. But I think there's a general sentiment that despite all the effort that has been put towards getting a public option as part of this reform, that the momentum inside Washington is shifting away from that. Talk about Rahm Emanuel and Charlie Rose the other night, indicating that it can't get through the Senate. Slinker Wink at Fire Dog Lake made mention of that. There was a little flap that Mike Lux had put out there on Open Left Huffington Post that the White House was floating the trigger proposal to progressive groups. Actually, the White House said that's not true, and Lux walked it back, saying he was convinced that that wasn't the case, but was happy that the White House felt compelled to have to say that wasn't the case. But even still, I think there's a concern that the White House is not 100% there on public option. But what do conservative bloggers think right now? Do they feel, and we talked about this a little bit earlier in the segment, but
yeah.
Are they feeling in the past 2 weeks that healthcare is a dead end, that it's a political bust for Democrats? They think there's not going to be a bill? Or is there a sense that maybe Obama's turned things around and a bill is going to happen, and the dynamics might be different than they were in August?
Well, first, let me ask you, am I the only person who's concerned that they are marking up a bill that does not exist?
I don't think that's actually technically true.
There is no bill.
You start with the chairman's mark, you start with a draft, and then the markup process is you add amendments and you mark it up. That's what they're doing.
Well, I know both sides do this, but my understanding is that the bill is not finished.
And well, what you may be referring to is, and this was a big 2 hours of debate on Wednesday, the way the Finance Committee has always operated, and I think this is different than other committees, but this is the way they've always operated, is they start with what they call conceptual language. They start with plain English language instead of the very arcane legislative jargon that if you look at, you know, no one could possibly follow. They start with the conceptual language. They vote their amendments in conceptual language. They vote the final bill in committee on conceptual language. And then at the end of that, they then give it to the staff aides to translate into legislative language. And then that's what gets taken to the Senate floor. And what caused some of the debate last week was CBO said it's going to take us a couple weeks to score it after you translate it into legislative language because some of the finer points might change our estimates.
Right.
And some of the Republicans, most notably Olympia Snow, who has been partial to what Baucus is doing but hasn't been an outright supporter, saying, I will not vote for a bill unless I get the absolute final CBO score. I'm not going to take the preliminary score off of the conceptual language. That's not good enough for me. Bunning, a Republican senator, said, let's have an amendment saying we will only vote after the legislative language is drafted and there's the final CBO score. That amendment failed, but it left people wondering, what's Snow going to do now? Is she going to be adamant and say, I'm not going to vote for this if we're voting on the conceptual language and the preliminary CBO score? Because if she doesn't vote for it, you still could possibly get it out of committee, although not if Rockefeller and Cantwell stick to their guns and vote for something that does not have a public option, which it most likely won't. And then does that change what Snow does on the final vote on the full Senate floor? Because by then there wouldn't be a final CBO score. It would be a legislative language. So would she be satisfied at that point, or would she be stubborn? So there's all sorts of uncertainty about that.
Man, and what a soap opera this has been. So to answer
your
question,
back to the larger point, how do conservative bloggers feel about the state of the process? Do they feel that stuff like that is making it hard for a bill to pass? Are they gleeful at the way this is going, or are they concerned that the Democrats got their footing back?
No, I don't think they're concerned that Democrats got their footing back. A few things to say. One, it's funny how conservatives – remember last week we were talking about how conservatives and liberals both hated the Baucus bill? Well, this trigger option is another example where both conservatives and liberals are convinced that it's, you know – a Trojan horse or something. Both sides are. And so we have that in common. I think that the general consensus among conservatives are that while they should not let their guard down and they should not quit fighting this, and I think that although the concerns over CBO scoring are very legitimate, I also think that delay is a helpful tactic for Republicans. But generally speaking, I think that conservatives believe that there will be some sort of health care bill passed, that it will not have the public option. And so it's a matter of watering it down. But then we get into the question.
They're going to get a bill passed, and it won't have a public option, which when they were equating with government takeover, wouldn't they be concerned that that's going to be accepted by the public in the end?
See, that's the irony that I talked about earlier, because there is a certain amount of irony there where you could argue that the worse this bill is, that the better it is for Republicans to do in November. But I don't really think that matters, because a lot of the bad stuff that would come out of this, whether it's a public option or not, wouldn't really manifest itself for years. It's possible that we would have a similar, you know, like happened in 93 or 94, actually. But I just don't, with Democrats having such majorities in the House and Senate, and President Obama being, remember, Bill Clinton didn't try this until his second year in office. This is, you know, Barack Obama has only been in office for nine months or so. And Democrats have such strong majorities. I really just find it hard to believe that they won't pass something and call it a victory. You know, call it success.
Jonathan Chait at the New Republic blog, the treatments, their healthcare blog, he had written, here you got the Baucus bill. The Baucus bill does not have a public option. And it was scored initially by the CBO as being a deficit cut. So, as Chait said, here you address the two major things that Republicans and conservatives were complaining about, and yet you get no Republican or conservative support for it. So it begs the question, you know, how can you possibly have a bipartisanship in this situation?
Right.
And also questions, you know, what could you possibly do to make Republicans and conservatives happy?
Right. Well, we talked about this, and I think you're
worried that this is going to undercut some sense of intellectual consistency if you get your concerns addressed and you still don't come on board.
And I think you're angling to get in the NewYorkTimes.com again, like we were last week when we talked about this. And my answer is going to be the same, which is, frankly, there is, you know, the problem with the Baucus bill for Republicans is it has mandates. It's essentially a tax increase.
But the Republicans used to be for the mandates. I mean, this came up with, I think Steve Bannon mentioned this and some others. You know, Grassley and Kyle explicitly were for the individual mandate in the Baucus committee earlier in this process, and now they're coming out against it. And Tim Foley at Change.org talked about it. Now, Mitt Romney said the individual mandate was the quintessential conservative plan because it's about individual responsibility, that I'm not going to be paying for your health insurance. You have to step up and pay for it yourself. That's conservatism.
Well, he's wrong.
And so why is it fading to the ether now?
No, I mean, that's not – I would say that that's a vast, vast minority position. And the fact that you can cite a couple examples, it does not mean that it's sort of within the mainstream of conservative thought. It's not. It's also essentially a tax increase. And I will admit to you, I do think that Republicans have made a strategic decision that it's smart politics to get nothing. But as I mentioned last week, I think that the problem is there is no way to compromise on healthcare reform, because the kind of reform that Republicans would want, I think, is dramatically different than the kind of reform that Democrats would want. I think at their heart of hearts, you know, let me say liberals. In their heart of hearts, liberals want a public option. I think that's obvious.
Yeah.
I can say personally, and I don't claim to speak for every conservative here, but I believe that fundamentally the problem with healthcare is that government gives tax breaks for companies, but they don't give the same tax breaks for individuals. And therefore, America has a system where the way that you get health care is through employment. And therefore, you never as an individual negotiate with health care companies or with hospitals or with doctors. It's always a third party. I think that distorts the market. I think it's artificial. And it's not surprising.
Who would change that?
It's not surprising that costs have ballooned. It would not change that. Barack Obama has been very clear that he would do nothing to change the way that...
Well, the individuals would get assistance in getting health care. They would be able to have anyone who does not have insurance, who is self-employed and does not have insurance, would be able to access the health care exchange, which under the House bills and the Kennedy bill would include a public option, and the Baucus bill would not include a public option. But in all those bills, you would get financial assistance if you could not otherwise afford it to buy health insurance, and therefore you're not trapped in a job. If you want to go out and be an entrepreneur, you got the great idea and you want to go pursue it on your own, you don't have to worry about losing your health insurance because you could quit your job and go into the exchange and get health insurance with assistance from the government. I mean, that would solve that problem, wouldn't it?
Well, but the fundamental problem is not – we could go on this for a long time. I just think we have a different vision for the future. My vision would be that individuals own their own health care and they go to private companies and they can go across state lines if they want to. They can go to whatever company they want and negotiate the best deal for them as an individual. And if they lose their job, they keep their health insurance. The government's not involved in it. And I think in your plan, government would be involved in it. And I think that you would have a situation where, think of any sort of other product you have. I mean, we're in this world now where everything, you do your banking online. If your bank doesn't give you a good enough deal, you cancel them and you go to Wachovia or Bank of America or whatever. You move around, you're entrepreneurial, individual. And so many people do such really cool things using technology, and I would even say the internet. They buy stocks. You can sign up today at E-Trade and have your own, portfolio. You can do all of that. I don't see why you need government to sort of intervene and to go to them. You should manage and own your own plan and negotiate your own deal. Once it's your employer, you're out of the picture. You're cut out. You have to take essentially what you've been given. And the other thing is, as an employee, if I go and the doctor says, "What's going to cost $500 for this?" I say, $35 deductible, charge $500 to my company." I'm not going to say, "Are you sure it's going to cost $500? Do I need this? Maybe I'll go to another doctor," as I would normally negotiate as an individual. So that's just a different, I think, worldview between conservatism and liberalism.
Well, the ideological debate aside, just to cap this off, conservative bloggers do feel that they still have the upper hand in this debate, that Obama going on TV, that the Senate Finance Committee moving forward, they still feel like they have the political upper hand in this debate. That's what you think?
That is my sense. I do not claim to speak for all of them, but my sense is that conservatives in general and bloggers specifically feel very comfortable, confident. I don't think anything's changed in the last couple of weeks since August. I don't think President Obama's speech scared anybody or was a game changer in any way. So we'll have to stay tuned. And I think we're good for today, Bill. Are you
another fantabulous edition of the Week in Blog?
That's right. And thank you, Bill, and thank you all for joining us. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at The Week in Blog, and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/TheWeekinBlog. Have a good day.
Have a good day and a good week to you, sir.
All right, man. Adios.
Take care.